We continue on with our series in Genesis 1 to 3, and our reading commences this evening at chapter 3, verse 7. Let us hear the word of the Lord. Then the eyes of Adam and Eve were opened, and they knew that they were naked, and they sewed fig leaves together and made themselves loincloths. And they heard the sound of the Lord God walking in the garden in the cool of the day. And the man and his wife hid themselves from the presence of the Lord God among the trees of the garden. But the Lord God called to the man and said to him, "Where are you?" And he said, "I heard the sound of you in the garden, and I was afraid because I was naked, and I hid myself." He said, "Who told you that you were naked? Have you eaten of the tree of which I commanded you not to eat?" The man said, "The woman whom you gave to be with me, she gave me fruit of the tree, and I ate." Then the Lord God said to the woman, "What is this you have done?" The woman said, "The serpent deceived me, and I ate." The Lord God said to the serpent, "Because you have done this, cursed are you above all livestock and above all beasts of the field. On your belly you shall go, and dust you shall eat all the days of your life. I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your offspring and her offspring. He shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel." To the woman he said, "I will surely multiply your pain in childbearing. In pain you shall bring forth children. Your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you." And to Adam he said, "Because you have listened to the voice of your wife and have eaten of the tree of which I commanded you, you shall not eat of it. Cursed is the ground because of you. In pain you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Thorns and thistles it shall bring forth for you, and you shall eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your face you shall eat bread, till you return to the ground, for out of it you were taken. For you are dust, and to dust you shall return." The man called his wife's name Eve, because she was the mother of all living. And the Lord God made for Adam and his wife garments of skins and clothed them. Earlier this year, I got into a conversation with a lady on a train between Philadelphia and New York. I was heading to the airport and she and her family were heading to a wedding. And in the course of the conversation, we got talking about the Bible. And I asked her if she'd ever read the Bible before. And it turned out she was a lapsed Catholic, and she had read a little bit of the Bible previously. So I said to her, "Have you ever tried reading one of the Gospels? It's a good place to start. You could start with the Gospel of Mark. It takes you about an hour." And she replied, "Yes, I think I might try that, because any time I've tried reading that first part of the Bible, the Old Testament, that God seems all angry and vengeful. And I find it hard to read. Jesus seems different." Now, the lady was saying two things. She was first saying that the God of the Old Testament was different, in her mind, to the God of the New Testament, to Jesus. And the second thing she was saying was that she preferred the God of the New Testament, who was different to the God of the Old Testament, because the God of the Old Testament was angry and vengeful, whereas the God of the New Testament was gentle and forgiving. And that is often how people view God in the Old Testament. And at one level, it's understandable, isn't it? I mean, let's be honest, it's not like the New Testament has as much bloodshed as the Old Testament, right? And doesn't Jesus tell his disciples to turn the other cheek to their enemies, whereas in the Old Testament, God tells Israel to go into the land and to destroy their enemies? So at one level, we can understand why people might get the impression that the God of the Old Testament is different to the God of the New Testament. More harsh, more angry, less forgiving. At one level, I understand why the lady on the train felt that way. She had a point, but it was only a superficial point. Because when you take time to read the Old Testament and to read it carefully, one of the things that strikes you is that God is perfectly just and incredibly gracious and merciful. Let me say that again. When you take time to read the Old Testament from the beginning, you find that God is perfectly just and incredibly gracious and merciful. And those three things about God, His justice, His grace, His mercy, they don't just appear and disappear in the Bible while His anger dominates. No, God's justice, God's grace, God's mercy, they flow through the Old Testament from beginning to end, like three colorful threads in a rich tapestry. And those three colorful threads of God's justice, grace, and mercy begin in this passage in Genesis chapter 3. But before we look at these three attributes of God, I want to give us a wee bit of context. And I'm going to set the context by giving you a quote from John Calvin. In Calvin's Institutes, Calvin said, "There is no true knowledge of self without a true knowledge of God, and there is no true knowledge of God without a true knowledge of self. There is no true knowledge of self without a true knowledge of God, and there is no true knowledge of God without a true knowledge of self." In other words, if you want to understand yourself, then you need to understand God. But also, what Calvin was saying was, if you want to understand God, you need to first understand yourself. Now, I think we get the first part of what Calvin was saying. If we want to understand ourselves, then we need to understand God. But I wonder if you've ever thought of the second part. That if you want to understand God, you first have to understand yourself. In other words, if tonight we're going to understand who God is, just like that lady on the train needed to understand who God was but didn't, if we're going to understand who God is, then we first need to understand who we are. And we do that by looking at our representative head, Adam, from whom we all descend biologically and covenantally. And verses 7 to 13 set the context for understanding who God is. It gives us an insight into who we are. And verses 7 to 13 give us three things about ourselves. First, we try to save ourselves. We try to save ourselves, verse 7. "Then the eyes of both were opened, and they knew that they were naked, and they sewed fig leaves together and made themselves loincloths." After we've sinned, we don't go to God for help. We turn to ourselves, because that's what Adam and Eve did. Adam and Eve were the first self-help therapists in the world. They believed that the answer to their deep shame after they'd sinned was not God, but self. Their sin had shamed them. And where did they go? To themselves. Their sin had blinded them. They looked inward. They tried to fix themselves instead of going to God for help. So that's the first thing we learn about ourselves. We try to save ourselves. The second thing is, we try to hide ourselves. We try to hide ourselves. Verses 8 to 10. "And they heard the sound of the Lord God walking in the garden in the cool of the day. And the man and his wife hid themselves from the presence of the Lord God among the trees of the garden. But the Lord God called to the man and said to him, 'Where are you?' And he said, 'I heard the sound of you in the garden, and I was afraid because I was naked, and I hid myself.'" Now there's a bit of irony here, because just think about it. Not only do the fig leaves not work, do you see that in verse 10? Adam says, "And I was afraid because I was naked." He's actually speaking with fig leaves on. Yet in the presence of God, he still feels naked. But the irony is, he's trying to hide from the God who was before all things, who made all things, who knows all things. Chapter 2, verse 8 and 9 tells us that God planted the Garden of Eden and caused trees to grow up in it. And here are Adam and Eve trying to hide from God in the very things that God has made, in the very things that God knows. So I mean, really, come on, Adam and Eve. Could you not have done better? And yet that is their fallen human nature. It's their instinctual response to sin, not to go out to God, but to run away from God, to hide from him. And it's our instinct as well when we have sinned. We hide. I have a friend back in Ireland who, I remember a funny story he told me when he was in church as a kid with his two sisters. They were misbehaving, and the dad leant across, told them to be quiet, and said, "I will deal with you when we get home." Well, they got home and they were told to go to their bedrooms. And when the father went in to one of the sisters' bedrooms to find her, to discipline her, she was gone. And he looked out the window and there she was, up a tree. She was so scared of what was going to happen. She knew she'd done wrong. What was she doing? Hiding. It's what we do in our natures. When we sin, we hide. And the third thing we see about ourselves is that we try to excuse ourselves. We try to save ourselves. We try to hide ourselves. And then third, we try to excuse ourselves. Verse 11 to 13. God said, "Who told you that you were naked? Have you eaten of the tree of which I commanded you not to eat?" The man said, "The woman whom you gave to be with me, she gave me fruit of the tree and I ate." Then the Lord God said to the woman, "What is this you have done?" The woman said, "The serpent deceived me, and I ate." Do you see how Adam passes the buck? "Adam, did you eat?" Well, actually, technically speaking, it was the woman. And notice what Adam passing on the buck entails here. It entails that God is ultimately at fault. You see that? "The woman whom you gave to me." I mean, God, look, if you just kept it, me and the animals, we wouldn't be having this discussion right now. See how Adam's trying to evade responsibility? And Eve does the same. God asks her, "Did you do this?" "Oh, it was the serpent made me do it." If you've heard the cliche, "The devil made me do it," well, Eve came up with a cliche. It's where it came from. But notice what her answer implies. "The serpent deceived me." Now just glance back to chapter 3, verse 1. "Now the serpent was more crafty than any other beast of the field that the Lord God had made." You see what she implies? Ultimately, God, this is your fault. You made the serpent. And it was the serpent who made me do it. And this is our fallen nature. When we are confronted by God with our sin, we try to save ourselves, we try to hide, and then we try to excuse ourselves. We try to blame someone else. It's always someone else's fault, not ours. Another friend of mine in Australia was telling me a funny story about his two boys, Ollie and Ben, who were in a living room, and a fight broke out, and Ollie came running out and showed his dad a mark on his leg. And he says, "Ben kicked me." And so my friend went in to deal with his son. And as he's questioning Ben, he said, "Did you kick Ollie?" And Ben went into denial mode. "No, I didn't kick Ollie." And so he started to penetrate a bit further. But Ollie has a mark on his leg. Before Ollie went into the room, he didn't have a mark on his leg. And now he does have a mark on his leg. "Did you kick Ollie?" "No. He ran into my leg." Now, what is he doing? He's evading responsibility. He's trying to blame something else, his leg or Ollie, for running into it. And that's what we do as individuals. We try to excuse ourselves. So those are three things we see about ourselves. We try to save ourselves. We try to hide ourselves. and we try to excuse ourselves. Now let me recall the second part of Calvin's quote, "There is no true knowledge of God without a true knowledge of self." In other words, if we want to understand God, we need to understand ourselves. Well, we've just seen what we're like. After the fall, after we've sinned, we don't come looking for God. We don't ask Him for help. We try to fix ourselves. We don't look for Him. We hide. We don't confess. We excuse. Now, if that's what we're like, the question is, what do we deserve? If that's what we're like, what do we deserve? Justice or grace? Punishment or mercy? Well, it's the former, isn't it? If after the fall, we continue to hide from God, continue to blame others and ultimately God for what has happened, then we deserve just punishment, don't we? Well, let's see how God responds to us. After having understood ourselves, let's now see who God is. And this passage reveals God in three ways to us. First, God's justice. God's justice. You can see this in two ways. The first is in verses 8 to 13. Notice how God carefully investigates sin. He carefully investigates sin. As he comes to talk to Adam, he treats this investigation a bit like an onion. You know, an onion where you peel off the skin, then you peel off one layer at a time. That's what God does with sin. He unfolds it one layer at a time. He doesn't come into the garden like with all guns blazing. "Adam, I know where you are. Come out. Stand before me while I punish you." No, he starts by asking questions. He peels Adam's heart open like an onion, one layer at a time. Verse 9, "Where are you?" He gives him the opportunity to say where he is. Of course, God knows where he is, but he's giving Adam the opportunity to confess. Then he gives Adam the opportunity to confess what he's done. Verse 11, "Who told you you were naked? Have you eaten from the tree of which I commanded you not to eat?" Then he gives Eve the opportunity to confess what she's done. Verse 11, "What is this you have done?" Do you see how patient God is? How slow to judge? There's nothing rash here. He doesn't come into the garden like an angry bull in a china shop. No, he takes his time. Even though he knows the end from the beginning, he takes his time and gives them the opportunity to confess. He carefully investigates sin before he judges sinners. And when he does eventually judge sinners, he fittingly punishes them. That's the second way we see his justice. And this is in verses 14 to 19. God fittingly punishes sin. He speaks to each of the parties in order of their participation in the fall. So he starts with the serpent in verse 14, since he initiated the whole thing. Then he speaks to the woman in verse 16, since she ate first. And then he speaks to the man in verse 17, since he ate last. What's interesting is that in each case, the punishment fits the crime. So the serpent's sin was a proud rising up against its creator. So its punishment is humiliation, verse 14. "Because you have done this, cursed are you above all livestock and above all the beasts of the field. On your belly you shall go." The serpent's initial posture was upright defiance against God. Now its posture will be a submissive one, a humiliating one all the days of its life. And since he attacked the Creator who gave him life, chapter 3, verse 1, he will ultimately receive death. Verse 14, "And dust you shall eat all the days of your life." It's going to be a life that leads ultimately to destruction. The serpent promised the woman that she would not die, and now he himself will die. Verse 15, "He shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel." The serpent is going to experience a killer blow. In other words, the punishment fits the crime. He said that the woman wouldn't die, Well, now he's going to die. Same goes for the woman. The punishment fits the crime. She was made to be a helper to her husband in bringing offspring into the world, but now she will experience pain in that role, in pregnancy and in childbearing. She was made to be the man's helper in ruling the world together in their marriage, and now she will experience conflict and domination in her marriage. She dominated her husband by encouraging him to eat, and so now he will dominate her. That's what verse 16 means. Your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you. There's going to be this marital conflict, this striving for who's in control. The punishment fits the crime, and the same goes for the man. He has failed to rule his wife by listening to her, and so now he will experience conflict in that rule, as verse 16 says. But he's also failed God by eating what was forbidden, and as a result, his own eating will be crushed. Notice in verses 17 to 19 that God mentions eating five times. Because you have listened to the voice of your wife and have eaten of the tree which I have commanded you, you shall not eat of it. Cursed is the ground because of you. In pain you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Thorns and thistles it shall bring forth for you, and you shall eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your face you shall eat bread. Just as Adam failed in his eating test, so now he will experience frustration in his eating. The punishment fits the crime. But it goes even deeper than that. Adam was made to rule the world, and that included plant life. His failure with one plant, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, leads to his frustration with growing other plants amid thorns and thistles. The earth was made for Adam to submit to him, but now it will rebel against him. And just as Adam tried to elevate himself up into the position of the Creator, so now he will return to the low position of the dust. He came from the dust, had the breath of life breathed into him, but now he will return to the dust. He will experience death because he disobeyed the God of life. The punishment fits the crime. And this is the second way we see God's justice. He fittingly punishes sin. I remember in the early noughties when the war in Afghanistan started, watching it on TV as the American forces and other allied forces went in and bombed the mountains in Afghanistan. I don't know if you can recall some of the images. And there was huge complaints and outcry about how disproportionate it appeared. Some felt it was disproportional to the crime of 9/11. Others felt it was so general. There were women and children in those mountains and villages receiving punishment for things they didn't do. The judgment of America and the Allied forces on the Taliban for hosting Al-Qaeda was too general. It entailed too much collateral damage. And sometimes I think people think that God's judgment on sinners is a bit like that. But we must understand from what we see in this passage, God does not judge sinners like that. God doesn't judge with blanket statements. God doesn't judge by the bucket load or the crate load. God's end time judgment on sinners won't be a carpet bomb punishment on all the human race. No, God judges by the bottle. On that final day of judgment, God will judge each sinner individually, and he will judge them carefully. He will investigate their sins slowly. He will ask them questions. He will peel back the layers of their heart, bit by bit by bit. And then he will deliver his punishment. And the punishment will be exact. It will be precise. It will be fitting. So that's the first thing we see about God in this passage. His justice, it is careful and it is fitting. If I could go back to that lady on the train, I would challenge her first statement about the God of the Old Testament. You see, he's not harsh. Yes, he does get angry, but it is always measured and proportionate anger. And when he does punish, he first investigates carefully, and then he punishes fittingly. God is a God of perfect justice. But alongside God's justice, there's also grace and mercy. In fact, in the Bible, whenever God judges with justice, he also saves with grace and mercy. When he judges with justice, he saves with grace and mercy. Let me put it like this. Someone has said that judgment salvation is the two-beat rhythm of the Bible. Judgment salvation is the two-beat rhythm of the Bible. Whenever you see judgment, you'll find salvation. Whenever God judges with justice, he saves with grace and mercy. Just take the flood, for example. Judgment and salvation. God judges the world, and at the same time, he saves a family in order to save the world. Take the Exodus from Egypt as another example. God judges the Egyptians with plagues and saves his son Israel from the angel of death. And then at the Red Sea, it's repeated again. God judges the Egyptians through the Red Sea, and he saves his people through the Red Sea. So those are two examples of that two-beat rhythm in biblical history. Judgment, salvation. Judgment, salvation. Judgment, salvation. And that two-beat rhythm starts here in Genesis. When God judges, he also saves. When he reveals his justice in judgment, he also reveals his grace and mercy in salvation. Let's look at God's grace. God's grace is his undeserved favor. Grace is receiving a gift you do not deserve. And we see this throughout this passage. I think we can see it in four ways. First, God seeks sinners. Verse 8. God seeks sinners. And they heard the sound of the Lord God walking in the garden in the cool of the day. Someone said that after the fall, the gardener did not abandon his garden. And that's true. But the other thing here is that God did not abandon his routine. The word walking here carries the idea that this was a regular thing for God to do. In other words, God would come on a regular basis into the garden at the end of Adam's workday in the cool of the afternoon to commune with Adam and Eve. Isn't it fascinating that after they fall, God doesn't break his routine? He comes again to commune with them. This is the first sign of grace. God comes to sinners after we have sinned and are hiding from him. The second is that God chooses sinners. Verse 15, the first part. I will put enmity between you and the woman. Now just think about that. God's going to put enmity between the serpent and the woman. In other words, he chooses Eve. He chooses to bring her back onto his side. Because think about it, Eve had joined with the serpent. She'd made an alliance with the serpent. So for God to put enmity between the serpent and the woman was to choose the woman back onto his side. There is grace here. Eve is the first elect member of the Christian church. That enmity is a sign of grace. Grace to Eve. God changes her heart. He gives her new affections. And God does it not because she asks him to. Remember, she's only had excuses when he confronted her with her sin. No, God chooses Eve because of his grace. The only thing the woman deserves is punishment alongside the serpent. But God acts in grace and gives her what she doesn't deserve. So we see that God seeks sinners, he chooses sinners. Third, he saves sinners. Verse 15, he promises a descendant from the woman who will bruise the head of the serpent, even though the serpent will bruise his heel. This is the promise of a representative son from the woman who will fight the serpent and save people from the serpent. The son will be injured in the fight, but he will ultimately be victorious. Eve and her offspring deserve none of this, not least because she's been getting on like the serpent, not speaking truthfully to God when he confronted her with her sin. Again, it's grace. God seeks sinners by grace. He chooses sinners by grace, and he saves sinners by grace. And fourth, God clothes sinners. Verse 21. And the Lord God made for Adam and his wife garments of skins and clothed them. Now, remember that Adam and Eve are not naked at this point. They've got fig leaves on. But as we saw in verse 10, in God's presence, even though you've got fig leaves on, you feel naked. And so God makes more robust clothes for them. And this is an act of grace because God clothes them at the expense of an innocent victim. Do you see that? Adam and Eve dressed themselves in fig leaves, but here God clothes them in skins, which means that an innocent animal must have died in their place. Here we have the very first hint of sacrifice in the Bible, where an innocent substitute dies in the place of guilty people. And why does God do it? Well, not because they confessed their sins. They've covered themselves, they've hid, they've excused themselves. The only thing they deserve is punishment. No, God does it because of his grace. So this passage reveals God as a God of grace. Seeks sinners, chooses sinners, saves sinners, clothes sinners. But there is another aspect of God that we can see, and that is his mercy. His mercy. If grace is receiving a gift we do not deserve, mercy is not receiving a punishment we do deserve. And God's mercy is present here. If you glance back to chapter 2, verse 16 and 17, God says that in the day that you eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, you shall surely die. The serpent comes along and says to Eve, you will not die. And so she eats, and Adam eats, and they don't die. So either the serpent was right and God was a liar, or God has chosen to delay his punishment. And if so, then that is an act of mercy. See, some scholars think that the death God promised was just spiritual death, and that it did arrive on the day that they sinned. They sinned, and then there was a spiritual breakdown between them and God, and so that's why they hid. And that is true, there was a spiritual breakdown. But that's to miss the point of verse 19, and that is that the punishment on Adam is ultimately death. But that death is delayed because of God's mercy. He does not give Adam what he deserves. He lets him live. And what's more, chapter 3, verse 20, the man called his wife's name Eve because she was the mother of all living. There's mercy again. They deserve death. She becomes the mother of all living. So there we have it. God's justice on the one hand, and God's grace and mercy on the other hand. Remember that picture or that musical note of the two-beat rhythm of the Bible? Judgment, salvation, judgment, salvation. Whenever God judges, he also saves. Whenever he reveals his justice, he also reveals his grace and mercy. And that is seen most clearly in the fulfillment of verse 15. God comes in judgment on the serpent, and at the same time he saves the woman and her offspring. In the very heat of judgment, there is salvation. In other words, God saves through judgment. He's judging the serpent, at the same time he's saving the woman and her offspring. And that comes to fulfillment in the person of Jesus Christ. On the cross, God judges Jesus as he fights the serpent and is injured. And at the same time as God judging Jesus with justice, He is saving sinners with grace and mercy. The two-beat rhythm reaches its crescendo at the cross, where wrath and mercy meet, where justice and grace are joined. But that two-beat rhythm is not just present in verse 15. It's actually here in verse 16 to 19. God judges the woman in childbearing. But how will she eventually be saved? Through childbearing. Through bringing about an offspring who will eventually bring about offspring who will be Jesus Christ. She is quite literally saved through childbearing. She's saved through judgment. The same goes for the man. God judges Adam in his work, and he will experience painful toil, sweat, thorns, and death itself. And how will he be eventually saved? Through a son who experiences painful toil, sweat, thorns, and death itself. Jesus Christ. Adam is saved through judgment. Just think about it. If Adam goes down into the dust in death, the judgment, then he can be raised from the dust in resurrection. If he remains alive in his state of rebellion, and Ian will deal with this next week as to why God won't let him eat from the tree of life. If he remains alive in his state of rebellion, never dying, then he can never be saved. The death that God predicts for Adam here is a punishment, yes, but it's also an act of grace, because it will be the means by which Adam will experience resurrection. In other words, even in the judgments on the woman and the man, God is preparing to save them. It's salvation through judgment. That two-beat rhythm runs all the way through the Bible. And it reveals that God is a God of justice in judgment and grace and mercy in salvation. This is the God of the Old Testament, not just the God of the New Testament. I don't know about you, but as I reflect on evangelistic conversations with people, I always think about what I could have said and what I could have said better. What I wish I had said to the woman on the tree in that day was, well, you could start with Mark's gospel, but actually, come to think of it, you should maybe start in Genesis. Read the first three chapters. Take you 12 minutes. And if you do, I think you might be amazed that the God you find there, perfectly just. He is careful in investigating sin. He punishes it fittingly. And then you will find that he is incredibly gracious and merciful. Why don't you start in Genesis? And you'll find a God of justice, grace, and mercy.